recorded by Donna Hartshorn in Jermaine Bray's office in the observatory on the Madison campus for the University Archives Oral History Project. Now, I suppose, Ms. Bray, that the logical way to proceed would be to start at the beginning. And I understand you were born in France, and I'm wondering what you could tell me about your early memories and a little bit about your family. What stands out in your memory?
I do remember France quite well, even though we left it when I was five, precisely because we left France and went to the Channel Islands. So the memories of that particular village in which I was born are very clear, and I know they date from that first part of my life. We were living in a small village in the Cévennes, in which my father, who was English, was a minister, because he had become converted to French Protestantism. And I remember the village extremely well. It had this one street. Of course, it's the Protestant part of France, the Huguenot part.
I see.
And I remember it was at that period they still had silkworms, and I can remember the silkworms.
Okay.
They completely disappeared. And when we came back to the south of France, I came back 10 years later, there were no more silkworms, that one had gone. So that I know is a memory, a very, very clear memory. My mother was French, and I remember my grandmother, who was Swiss, who lived with us. And my father was, of course, English citizen, and English citizen of French origin, being a Channel Islander.
Oh, he was a Channel Islander.
Yes, he was a gentleman. And he was naturally bilingual, because in his family, the children were sent, the boys were sent to the French lycée from Jersey. And after they had studied in France, then they would study in England, as his brothers did, the University of London or whatnot. And my father, therefore, had this double education. And my mother belonged to the French Protestant family, and like many French Protestants, since they're not so very numerous in France, she was from Lorraine. She had friends in England, and when she was about 15, she had been to England and spoke English extremely well. She had a slight accent, that French R, which all her children inherited, because she taught us English. One of the first memories I have is of sitting on the floor while my mother was teaching my two elder sisters. They were my half-sisters, my father's, and the first marriage, my father. She was teaching English on the blackboard in one of the rooms, and I was sitting on the floor, and I still remember being fascinated by this, and possibly I then began to learn English that way, which was very early. They were both completely bilingual, both parents. So I had wonderful memories, of course, of the south of France. I always, when I came back, I recognized so many things that I had obviously taken in as a child.
You mentioned both parents were bilingual. Did they use both languages in the home?
Yes.
How did they speak
they
to one another?
They, at first, you see, now when we were in France and I was small, they used English when they wanted to speak without being understood by
it. Oh, I see.
Many children. we were a very large family. And they would speak English. But then the time very quickly came. One of the really lucky things, many people are bilingual, but one of the lucky things, I think, was the fact that we were totally immersed in one language and then in another language and back to the other language for periods of time, so that the two languages kept them going. But as soon as we went to the Channel Islands when I was five, and I can remember, we went by train, of course, I can remember parts of the journey, and then I can remember getting on the boat, even. But once we started to know English, of course, they couldn't do that, and my mother made a really valiant attempt to keep our French going by trying to have us speak French at home. which has always been a difficult thing to get children to do when they're in a one environment, they don't actually want to speak the other language. But she did manage to keep us going in French while we were talking English. And anyhow, the Channel Islands at that time, I think it's no longer true, there were many people who spoke French. There were many French people of French origin.
Well, that must have made it easier too. Some French going on.
Yes. It made it easier to insist that we keep up this.
Well, made it less artificial, I suppose.
So my first 5 years were spent in this village in the Cévennes, which is the title of the book that came out later, not by me, but by a colleague of mine. And then my next 10 years were spent in the Channel Islands, with visits to England, where my father's brother lived. One of his brothers was in Argentina, another one was in India, but one was indeed in England. And we spent some time in Guernsey, 4 years, and some time in Jersey. So that was the next very clear slice of life, because that was very particular, the Channel Islands were delightful. And we spent the war years there, which was very lucky for us, because they, in World War I, the Channel Islands were absolutely safe. Of course, in World War II, they were occupied, but that's another story.
That's another story. We'll get to that.
That's another story. But that's where we spent the next 10 years, and there I went to a very good English school, they call it public school, one of the private schools. And that's where I did all my my secondary education, and until I was 15, and took my senior and matriculation, and then went back to France. Now the memories of the Channel Islands, of course, all have to do with the sea, swimming, and flowers. They're full of flowers, the Channel Islands at the time.
Oh, nice!
And as you know, the great resource of the Channel Islands is also milk. They had Jersey cows. And I remember we used to go to a farm and get our milk. It was warm from the cow. What do you call it? From the
udders?
Yes, they'd just be milk. They had just warm from the milking.
It wasn't pasteurized or anything.
No, it was just straight from the milking. And I can remember how extraordinary it seemed, and even trying to milk a cow, which I've never been able to do and couldn't do. It's very hard to milk a cow. But there in that school, I did have an English education, which meant that I had a good deal more physical exercise than I would have had in a French lycée.
Oh, explain that, would you? Why is that?
Well, French lycées are... I was in an English boarding school. Of course, French lycées did very, very little physical education at the time. You had a great deal of classes were very tightly scheduled, and if you wanted to do sport of any kind, you had to do it outside. You don't. It was a very rigorous kind of education I went back to, and which I appreciated quite a bit. But on the other hand, my English education was better balanced from the point of view of games, swimming, general freedom within the system, which we didn't, the French schools at the time didn't allow. It changed in 1968. It was one of the reasons for some of the student unrest, that this rather tight and rigorous education with lots and lots of homework.
More homework than in the English school?
Oh yes, a good deal more homework. And less freedom in every way. I mean, you were taught, you had to memorize a good deal in the French system, and you had to write and you have to write with no kind of leeway as to structure, development. You were taught that you had to present a dissertation in this form, you know, introduction, point one, point two, point three, conclusion. And you couldn't stray very far, and also in interpretations of texts. There was a set pattern that was transmitted through of the culture, which was transmitted through the educational system. And it was much freer in England. In England, this was an English school in Jersey.
Mm-hmm. Which system did you enjoy the most?
Well, in a way, I enjoyed them both. I suffered under the French system when I came back. I was young, I was 15, and I was about really a year ahead, almost 2 years ahead, largely because I had been kept going with my two elder sisters, who were 3 and 4 years older than I was. So I had moved along the track rather ahead. And so I was put into a French school. I was supposed to be then going on to Oxford, but this didn't happen because of the circumstances right after World War I. I was born, let me see, in 1907, so it was in the mid-20s. And that was, of course, when the Fronde just crashed, and it was not possible for me to go back to England for study at the time. But I appreciated the French discipline. The French really taught me how to work. And I've worked ever since and enjoyed it. And I also enjoyed the rigor of it. One would rebel. And I very often, coming from an English background, I was very ready to tell my professors that I didn't think the way they did. But that was soon put a stop to. I remember one professor, I was at school at Nîmes, I was old, 16 maybe. And I remember she raised quite an outcry. She said I was bringing in the habits of a foreign country, which was England, into the school.
She was objecting to this?
She was objecting very strongly. She was a teacher of French literature, and we hadn't seen eye to eye, and I was surely probably wrong, but I was saying what I thought, as I had been more accustomed to do in my English schooling.
I see. Well, you didn't go to Oxford. What did you do then?
Then I went right through the French system. And it's one of the things that it was baffling, because for 2 years I started literally back as if I were 12 years old and went through the whole system, and I was 15.
Why did they put you back?
Well, my parents had thought really that I was only here for a year and that I would be going on to England, and so it was not that I in the classes, but I took the exams. I took the whole set of exams, the ones you take at 12, the ones you take the Certificat d'études, brevet, and I was going through the wrong track in a sense. I was going through, they have two tracks, they no longer do. The what they call the primary, which was for people who don't go beyond a certain stage, and the secondary, and since apparently I was there only for a short time and would go on then, my parents obviously thought that I would learn French, which I did. Mm-hmm. And strictly so, and then I would move on to England, and it was a while before I realized that I was in the wrong track, and then I was able to move into the secondary system because of I had my English diplomas.
Oh, I see.
Can you see I had to realize how the French system worked, which my parents weren't too familiar with, either of them.
And you didn't have any particular trouble shifting from one track to the other?
Not if you've got the right diplomas, which I had. I had the equivalent, which gave me entry into then the university. After having spent, 3-4 years
in the wrong track. That gave me entrance into the Sorbonne. And once I was in the university, then things went very smoothly for me. But they took a little while. And I loved France, of course. We were back at that time, when we came back to France, we were back in, not in the village in which I was born, but in the Cévennes, which is the Protestant center of southern Protestantism, because there is also the Alsatian Lutheran Protestantism.
It sounds as though your whole family moved back to France, is that correct?
Yes, my father moved back to a church in France, in the south of France.
So that you all went it. I wondered for a minute if you just gone off to school by yourself.
No. My parents had left me 1 year alone at my school. It was called Jersey Ladies College, of all things. Now it's called Jersey School for Girls, which is not the point. They left me alone 1 year there so that I would finish my secondary school curriculum, which was very wise of them, and then take my exams at the end. And so I was they left me 1 year up there, and then I came back and joined them in the south of France.
So all of this seems to have taken a lot of time. When did you finish your formal education?
Well, I really actually caught up, because what I did was to concentrate on English. Now, at the Sorbonne, you take a licence. At the time, you took 4 certificates. And I was able to do that in 2 years. And then you do a thesis, which is like an MA thesis. And then you pass the aggregation, which is a competitive exam. Once you've passed that, you are sure of a job. This is one of the things I have never known, is job insecurity.
That's very nice.
It's awfully nice, and I often think of the young people we have here who have to worry so much and spend so much time applying for jobs. Once you pass the agreg, then the French government has to assure you a teaching position. And unless you do something horrendous, terrible, they may displace you if there's some complaint, but they do not fire you normally.
I see.
But in between, I went 1 year to America.
Well, how did that happen?
I belong to the generation which is the generation of Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir. I'm just 3 months older than Simone de Beauvoir.
Oh.
And if you read her memoirs, you will find out how the American myth, how strong it was because of the movies. And we all dreamed of America. America was really the country of our imagination.
I see.
Today I have grand nieces and nieces whose imagination goes the other way. They want to go, one of them wants to go to Egypt to learn Arabic. My niece is off to China to learn Chinese and all the rest of it. But for us it was America. And so one day I was at the time at the University of Paris and preparing my exams, and I ran into a young woman who said to me, "Could you tell me where this amphitheater is? Because I don't know where it is. I've just come back from America." And I said, "How did you get there?"
What theater?
The amphitheater where they lecture.
Oh, yes.
Lecture. Yeah. And I said, "How did you get there?" She said, "I applied at this agency," which was an agency, Franco-American agency. And I applied, and my application was accepted, and Bryn Mawr offered me a fellowship. So it's just by chance that I was delighted. All I wanted to do was to go to America, and I was foreign fellow at Bryn Mawr for the year of preparation of my exam, my last exam, which was like a 31-32. So I was not that old.
And were you studying at Bryn Mawr, or were you teaching, or doing a little of each?
I was only studying. They had these farm fellowships. They were very good fellowships. And we were entirely free to study. I can't say we studied because it was so fantastic. to live the campus life, which of course I hadn't lived in a way. At the University of Paris, I was earning my living in any case. And I enjoyed it very much. For the first time in my life, you know, I enjoyed this freedom within the university structure. I had been, you know, I had been going to lectures and then coming back and had very little time to play around with other students. We didn't have a work group that we sort of prepared our exams together, but I was often too busy.
Mm-hmm. I see. So that was a good year.
It was a wonderful year. And it changed all my life, because I went back, took my exam, passed it, and was assigned a job, a post in North Africa. I taught there for 4 years, and then Bunmore called me back, offered me a lectureship in French literature, though I had majored in English literature. Like, always a considerable part of the part of the requirements are in French literature, of course, being France.
Mm.
So I had a good, solid preparation in French literature, though not nearly as solid as my French colleagues, because I had been brought up in England. So that all the lycée preparation in French literature was lacking for me. I had only the university, and I had to catch up. Quite a bit. On the other hand, my preparation in English literature was very good. And that's why I think that I was lucky, in a sense, to have that double educational experience. And then 1 year of graduate school in America, and it makes a rather pleasant kind of combination.
It sounds so.
At least for me.
So you didn't really mind this shift from English literature to the French?
No, I didn't mind it. I worked very hard and probably did some very strange teaching. I don't know, because I had to feel my way through some of the material, particularly since Bryn Mawr is very demanding. It's a very good place to do one's apprenticeship in, because the standards were high, the students were very good.
That's what I understand.
And the expectations were quite clear. The chairman of my department, who was a wonderful woman, a very firm woman, by the name of Eunice Morgan Skeck, was quite clear as to what she expected from the people in her department. She picked you. And she followed you. And it was a small department, it was a small college, 800 students, mm. I think, at the time, if that.
Mm.
But the standards were very high in the graduate school, of course. And had I not had that experience in the graduate school at Bryn Mawr, I would have been much less well prepared for teaching later on in the university like Wisconsin or NYU.
Let's backtrack a little bit to what you were doing in Africa.
Oh, in Africa I was teaching in the lycée, that is a secondary school, and I was teaching English. And as you know, the lycée has 2 years. It really corresponds to the first 2 years of college. The last 2 years of the lycée correspond to the first 2 years of college, about. So I was teaching as you teach in the lycées, that is, the curriculum is centrally established in Paris. I think that's something which is changing. So you had your syllabus. You didn't establish your own syllabus. You knew what you taught. You know, you knew that in such a class you taught the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, and when you got to the philo, you taught Hamlet. After you've done that 4 years, then you're very pleased to get a change, at least I was.
Well, I would think so.
Well, it was. I enjoyed it. I've always enjoyed teaching. We had 40 students. students in a class quite often, and I taught from the 12-year-olds up to the 18-year-olds.
Do you have boys and girls, or
just girls?
Just girls.
Yes, the nieces were absolutely segregated then. I think that has changed to a certain extent now. I think that maybe they have desegregated quite a bit.
Now, where in North Africa was this?
This was in Oran, Algeria, at the Lycée of Oran. That's where I did my first 4 years of teaching. We also did a lot of traveling in North Africa at the time, and of course a lot of swimming. I found the sea once again, which has always been one of my greatly loved the sea and always wanted to swim whenever I could get a chance.
The Sherwood Pool isn't quite the sea, but it's nice.
Yes, it's nice. And when I first came here, I came here in the 60s, I swam in Monona Lake.
Did you?
And at the end, after I no longer did, because it was no longer as clean.
Yes, the weed problem has gotten worse and worse.
Yes, weed problem had gotten, it was no longer pleasant as well. Perhaps the lake was lower, I think. I may be wrong, but I have a feeling that it was lower. I was living on the edge of Monona Lake.
This I don't know. It could have been. I think it does fluctuate some.
Mm-hmm. So that was where I was teaching those 4 years, and doing a lot of travel, traveling down to North Africa, visiting as I went down, for example, Spain and Italy, coming up again when we came back for the summer vacation, traveling in North Africa, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia. We were all 24, 25, a whole bunch of us down there, and every vacation we would be off on our way to the south. So I saw quite a bit of the countryside, and I'm glad I did.
Oh, it sounds quite exciting. Did you have long vacations?
Just the ordinary school year of the Christmas vacations, something like, I think, 10 days, and the 2 weeks of the Easter vacation. I forget how long the vacations were, because some vacations we went for, or traveling. We didn't stay in North Africa. But we spent a lot of time during the teaching period. We spent a lot of time on the beaches.
We did.
Yes, the beaches of North Africa are just marvelous. I don't know how they are now, but they were just marvelous. Beautiful beaches, wonderful swimming.
Oh, great. Now, roughly when was this? What were these?
31. I went there in 32, October 32. I passed my exam, my agreg, in the summer of 32, and I came back from America. Got through my exam, and was assigned Oran, the Lycée of Oran. They ask you where you want to go, and I had said I wanted to go to Indochina. Or to Persia, as it was called then. They would never have sent a young woman off to places like Isfahan. Now, I was very romantic at the time, and my idea was to get a job as far out as possible, like Hanoi. And or I was dreaming of Isfahan or Tehran. Tehran, I think, where the French lycée was. But they had more sense. They sent me to North Africa.
Well, that's too bad. So you were there for 4 years until about 36, and that is when you came back to Bryn Mawr?
That's when I came back to Bryn Mawr. Bryn Mawr offered me a lectureship, and I came back to Bryn Mawr, and thus I stayed, except for the couple of years I spent in the French Army.
Well, tell me about that. Tell me about the French Army. How did you get into that?
I volunteered. I don't have to tell the story of this. It was a miserable period for the French.
Oh yes, I understand that.
And the quarrels between the French were very painful. at least I felt that, and a certain number of my friends, French friends, felt that too. So after the Americans got in, there were called for volunteers, and there was a group of volunteer ambulance drivers that was being organized. And I volunteered and was accepted in this group. There were about 15 women ambulance drivers.
In the United States, not because of our American friends, but largely because of our French compatriots.
You mean the ones here?
Yes, because, you know, the Gaudis wouldn't speak to the Pétainistes, and it was just so painful to have all these quarrels going along with France occupied in any case, and being cut away as we were. And I had part of my family in London, which didn't make things any better. And of course, I was separated from my family in France. And the only thing to do was to seem to me to volunteer. And once you're in uniform, nobody asks you any questions. You don't have to take a position. You're just classified, you know. So I volunteered and we left for North Africa. We didn't know we were going to North Africa, and we left, and we were assigned to the 2nd Armored Division, which had just come up from the Chad. And we were bringing 24 ambulances and a whole lot of medicine, so that we were rather welcome in that division. So that is where I was first assigned there. And then I think some 6 months, I was in the army about 2 years, some 6 or 8 months later, the French organized the Women's Army, or was it a year later? I'm very vague on dates.
That's all right.
And I was transferred to the G2. So I was transferred, we had been in Rabat, I was transferred to Algiers. And then from there I was transferred to the headquarters of the French general commanding the 8th Division, the 8th District, which was Dijon, was just behind the front. It was very, very safe. I'm not pretending that there was any danger attached. It was very, very safe. But I was there because the headquarters of American headquarters were there. There was Continental Advance Section in particular, because the advanced supply base for the French First Army. So I was assigned there, and then I was moved when the Americans and French moved into Germany. I was then attached to the Continental Advance Section that was moving in behind to the American headquarters.
And were you still driving an ambulance?
No. I was, when I went into the G2, which was intelligence.
Intelligence, that's right.
So I'm sure they could have done without my services perfectly happily. that's why I was at the time of, I was in Mannheim's 2nd Iron District at the time of the, when it wasn't an armistice, when the hostilities stopped. And we went on, we went as far as the Brenner. Travel a lot in the army, free. Not always comfortably. But
what kinds of things were you doing then?
When I was with the...
In the G2.
G2, well, when I was in Algiers, I was with the headquarters of the French military command, and I was mostly using my English for either interpretation, or I did work with certain files, for example, files that had to do sometimes, as I remember, with certain agents that had been, for example, parachuted into France, and I remember one file of an agent which had come back, he had been captured, and that kind of thing, you know. And other things like the shunting of trains back and forth, they all had these numbers. And I was supposed to try to find out what whether one could find out where they were going to and fro from, you know, which I didn't do very well at all. I didn't make much out of that. But I had assignments of that kind, the usual assignment. That by that time I was second lieutenant, but I had been up to then. I had been private. When I was an eminent staff, I was private second class. Then when the French army organized the Women's Corps, they promoted me to, because of my dignity as a university professor.
Oh, I see.
They promoted me to second lieutenant.
Great.
You know, what a second lieutenant can do in headquarters is really not very much. It's routine kind of work.
Oh well, it's a step up from private.
and you know, keeping sort of happy relations with, I always got on very well with the Americans. I never had any complaints about them at all, so I could do some translation, some interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this must have been very useful for them.
Well, yeah. There were many. Many competent people who could do it too. But it was fun for me, in a way.
So you stayed with that then till the war ended?
Then, as I said, I was transferred to the headquarters of the general commanding the 8th Division, in which, of course, I was much closer to the work of the Continental Advance Section, because I was constantly... I was, in fact, the interpreter then. There was only one with me on the French side.
Uh-huh.
I represented the French side, so I was closer to any kind of incidents that would occur that had to be smoothed out. And incidents, you know, small incidents that occurred that had to be smoothed out.
What kind are you talking about?
Well, I can remember one case that had to do with a rape of a rather elderly woman, you know, with troops around. And another case, which was an absolutely hilarious case, in which a young woman had awakened in one, it was one of the big high-rise, one of the big apartments, but I'm getting mixed up, this was in Algiers, and she woke up and saw this man absolutely naked standing there, and he was a perfectly innocent young American soldier who had got so drunk that he had come to the wrong door. He had an apartment on the floor below and couldn't get in, and had deposited this envelope that said, "Top secret," at the door, taken off all his clothes, and got in. It was one of those really high, got in, nobody knows how, by balancing on this little edge.
Well, drunk?
Dead drunk.
Oh,
and he was standing there, and he was trying to see, and she, of course, screamed. He had stepped into the window. And he had no intention, except that he got into a lot of hot water because he had left that top secret, and this was not kind of becoming a young captain, I have to give it a captain. So I was in on the court-martial of this poor guy, and he was very, very, he was very funny, because every time that questions were put to him, he would get up, he would answer, and he would get up and bow. The girl was there and say, "I am very sorry that I inconvenienced you, madame." And he was indeed. It was one of these strange things. And the brother of this young woman, who was a captain in the French army, had said to me, "I want you to be our interpreter in this case." That's how I was there. And he would say to me, he would turn to me, every time they had asked questions, and indeed, the young man kept saying, "I don't remember anything," and he had been dead drunk. And the brother of the girl to which happened would say to me, "Tell them I don't care about their investigation, but I want to know how he got from door A to door B." Which was a feat of acrobatic feat that he had managed to pull off. And this question reappeared 3-4 times, and I was sorry for the guy, of course. But I thought I was going to laugh out loud.
Well, it is funny.
It wasn't funny for the boys.
Well, I'm sure it wasn't. He was in big trouble.
He was in big trouble. We don't know what happened to him, because after the hearing, we don't hear, but I think probably he was sent to Vietnam or some, it wouldn't be Vietnam, it would be the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
He was probably sent out to the Pacific Front or something like that. I don't know. So, I mean, you had all kinds of things that happened mm-hmm. that you did. And then after that, I went in then with Continental Advanced Section, but then what I did was quite, in a way, different, because we would go back and forth between the French. You see, everybody was advancing. Everybody was moving. You know, pattern. And the French First Army was moving, and we mm-hmm. would be sent on very routine jobs. But the French army was moving, we'd be told, go to Frankfurt for this, but by the time we were in Frankfurt, heavens knows where the first French army had got by then. They headed down towards the Lake of Constance.
Mm-hmm.
So we kept running after.
Yes, I remember at the end of the war, things
yes.
happened very quickly.
Very, very, very quickly. And we would see quite a lot of the countryside as we wandered around in search of our headquarters, which we were supposed to be contacting about anything about Nazi personnel. They were hunting down the Nazi personnel. And who was in what zone? This was the question of the different zones and
mm-hmm.
keeping in touch with what was happening in the different zones. So that was it. But very routine. Jobs.
Mm-hmm. But some of them funny.
Some of them funny, very often mm-hmm. funny.
How long after the end of the war did you stay with them?
Oh, I moved as soon as I could to get back to Bryn Mawr. As you may remember, August is the time when the European front closed down. I mean, it was finished. Do you remember the? Wasn't it August that they crossed the...
My memory was that it ended in the Pacific in August.
Yes, but I mean ended before. I left in August. I could have stayed on, but there was nothing to do. And I very much wanted to get back to Bryn Mawr. So I then made the right moves and what I was told to do, and took one of the boats back. It was a sort of troop ship too.
Mm-hmm.
But we were very well, we were 8 or 9 in a cabin, but we were in cabins, the women were in cabins, and was demobilized in New York.
In New York?
Yes.
Some of them went to Virginia, I think.
We started from Camp Patrick Henry.
Where is that?
Norfolk, Virginia. And moved from, that's where we left, for North, when we went to North Africa first, landed in Casablanca,
mm-hmm.
when we joined the 2nd Armored Division. But I came back by New York, which was convenient for Bryn Mawr, yeah.
Did you have to go to a camp there?
No, there was there were not too many of us who had volunteered. There were a handful, really. Of us who, and the French had a special, some kind of special agency where we reported and were demobilized.
So it was very simple.
It was very simple.
Well, and there wasn't any problem about Bryn Mawr accepting you back.
Oh, Bryn Mawr was very, very understanding. They had held my job for me for those 2 years. And kept track of me. In fact, they were the ones who helped me get out, because they put in a request to have me back.
Well, they, of course, would have wanted you back by the beginning of the teaching year.
That's right.
They?
And I came back for the beginning of the teaching year, just about. That would say just about when I returned. I forget the dates now. I came back just for the beginning of the teaching year. And was I pleased to be back?
France, we're delighted.
And how long did you go on teaching it at Bryn Mawr?
I went on teaching at Bryn Mawr until 53.
And then what happened?
And then I was offered the position of chairman of the Department of French at NYU, and the year after that, head of the Department of Romance and Slavic Languages. And they were, I suppose they tried me out for a year and then thought I could fill that slot. It was, Slavic languages was a very small thing. It was an administrative responsibility. We had a small Russian section that was delightful. And of course, I don't know a word of Russian, but I was just the administrative person there, you know, for the budget and whatnot.
Now, this, how did you like this change?
Well, I rather liked it. It was a bigger job than I had realized, because they had two undergraduate schools at the time, one up at University Heights and one at the Square. And they had an evening school, which was already 3 years, plus a graduate school that worked at night. All the graduate courses were given at night. And that made a rather large department. I think we were 50 or so at the time.
Oh, you had to keep track of all of this?
I had to keep track and of all the sections, and in a very different system from Bryn Mawr, which was not of the same kind. Bryn Mawr didn't go on what I call the dollar credit point system.
What is that?
So many credits, so many points, you know, a 3-point course, so many dollars. And you pay your dollars and you take the course. And people come in and they take 2 courses, you know. You know the way it works in those big cities. Mm-hmm. They come in at night and they slowly build up. And Bryn Mawr, it doesn't work like that. It works on a program for the year. You come in, you pay your fee, and then you have a program set up.
Yes, this is a very different arrangement then.
It's a very different arrangement, yes. And I had to get used to it. And I came in the summer and worked in the summer there to get used to the system. And very often was totally lost. And then little by little, my colleagues were very, very good, and the administration was very patient. They taught me quite a bit.
Had you done any administrative work at Bryn Mawr?
No.
So this was completely new.
It was completely new. And certainly, the departments of Bryn Mawr, being small, worked very closely together. I mean, people worked very closely together. But here, the size of it was really rather staggering. It was rather interesting, though. Those were the years where everything was developing. And part of the fun of being there at the time was that here was a university that was going up. It had vowed to really improve the university and to become equal to Columbia. It was the years when Charles the Heald came in, and he just took that university, and in the next years the university was making enormous strides, trying to get quality, trying to get a curriculum of a certain kind, and there were the students, of course.
Mm-hmm.
This was after we had all these veterans, we had...
This has been the time of the GI Bill.
A lot of
young people went back to college on that.
Yes, we had mature people and all kinds of people, of course. The that was also a change from Bryn Mawr. The variety of the student population was so great. Whereas at Bryn Mawr, you have highly selected group, both socially speaking, in spite of the fact that they give a lot of scholarships, they're still socially selected, and of course very, very carefully selected academically.
Mm-hmm. Well, they have a very good reputation.
Oh yes, it was a good place. But this was in a way more fun, because you know you had to deal with all kinds of people and all kinds of students, and the department and the whole university and the department village was building up. And in these years now, I wouldn't like to be chairman of the department when you have to curtail and cut
back. Budget problems, and yes.
Yes.
It wouldn't have,
it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking for chairman of the department to have to cut down.
I'm sure it must be. Yeah. And I can sense the excitement when things are changing and moving ahead.
That's right. And I had these teaching assistants. You see, I was able to hire teaching assistants. And the pool in New York is very diverse. And I had one of the most wonderful teams of teaching assistants that one could hope to have in those years. They were just wonderful. And so all this made for excitement and a very, very busy life. I must admit that it was after I did 7 years of it, it was time that I would have had to slow down.
7 years of that is quite a bit.
Yes.
Did you do some teaching too?
Oh my, yes. When I first went to NYU, I was actually teaching 3 courses, and then they cut that down to 2. But of course, since I was chairman of the department, and still since the place ran from 8 in the morning to 10 o'clock at night, there were days that were very, very long for the chairman, or the, whatever they call it, head. But it's all the same.
Did you have to stay there all that time?
No, but sometimes I had to be there early. And I, since, again, by the chances of getting an apartment, I was living near Columbia, up on the drive, where I got my apartment. I couldn't commute back and forth. That takes too much time in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So I sometimes spent very long days down there.
Well, I can see where that might have been. What were you teaching French literature?
I was teaching French literature, 20th century French literature. So that was my field, of course. I was teaching graduate course and a couple of undergraduate courses at the beginning, and then I only taught 1 undergraduate and 1 graduate. I only taught, say I. That was plenty.
Well, I would think so, with all the other activities you had to supervise. You were there for 7 years?
I was there for 7 years, yes.
As chairman the whole time?
Well, I was chairman of the French section the first year, and I was head of the whole Romance and Slavic language department for the rest of the time.
So,
but you know, you delegate a lot. There was the chairman of the Spanish section would really take care of the Spanish section. You had to agree on budgets and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But so that's,
well,
that's
someone had to coordinate all this.
You have to coordinate. But I was helped quite a lot. One of the professors in the French section was also one of the administrators. He was assistant dean or something, or dean, I forget what, he was one of the deans, and he helped me a great deal on things like budget, where I was told I never had a budget before.
That would be complicated, I imagine.
Oh, my.
With it.
Yes. But he really took the responsibility of that. Otherwise, I'm afraid there would have been tremendous disruption if I had had to do it by myself.
I can imagine. It could be quite confusion.
Yes.
Now, when did you decide to become a United States citizen?
I think it was 52 or 53.
What influenced that decision? I understand that you at one time could choose between being British or French.
Yes.
And you chose French.
Yes.
Let's start with that. Why did you choose that?
Well, I felt very close to the French, perhaps because my mother is French, we've been living in France, and since then I have become much more aware of what ties I have with the British too. But at the time I was a little anti the English, in large part because my father's family in England were a great deal better off than we were, and we always had the sort of role of somewhat of the poor cousins, and you know, the English respectability and the British sense of superiority.
Yes.
And at the time of my adolescence annoyed me. I was annoyed because they seemed to think of the French. I think they understand the French much better now, but at least they always seemed to think the French were somewhat inferior. And I was quite fascinated, of course, by France, the French. And I had a great solidarity with the French. And felt, and didn't approve of the English attitude. My uncle, on the other hand, my English uncle, had a French education and was very open to the French. And among my nephews, I have two who are extremely fascinated by France.
Do they live in France?
Oh no, they. Yeah. One of them lives in Canada, the other lives in England. But they are drawn to the French. They don't take the attitude of, you know, but sometimes the British used to. They no longer do. This was, well, the British say, well, you know, the French, they don't do this and they don't do that, and they have a sense that the British they have, but they no longer have it. Were far superior in all kinds of ways. And I didn't like that. And then I got to very much closer to the English later on, from World War II on, when they went through, they had so much, you know, they went through so much.
Mm-hmm.
But I had, as well, now I chose America for all kinds of reasons. First, because I felt very much at home in America to begin with. All my professional career was set in America, and I realized that you cannot feel totally at home if you can't participate in the political discussions. I feel very strongly that if you're a foreigner, you can't say what you think in the same way. At least I couldn't. You can't tell the Americans. If you're an American, you can say, this is what I think, and that's why I think it. If you're a foreigner, you have to be very careful not to impinge upon the thinking of the American citizen. After all, it's their country, it isn't yours, and you don't participate in the same way. And I also felt the same for the university situation. If I was to have any kind of voice, it would have to be as part of the institution. The Americans I have always found extraordinarily generous in the way they deal with foreigners, and I have also sometimes found that foreigners are very annoying in the way they keep passing judgment on the Americans while living in America, and I don't like that. And possibly that is a great part of my English training that I have interiorized. I think the English are very sensitive to this kind of thing. At least it seems so. But anyway, those were the reasons, many of the reasons why, among the many reasons why I decided that I wanted to be an American citizen.
So when did you do this?
52, 53. 52, I'm not sure exactly.
Mm-hmm. Somewhere around in there.
That's right. Yeah, you take it. You take, if you're a citizen, you take the whole thing. I don't know if you see what I mean.
Oh, I think I sense
the good and the bad.
And it's a very subtle distinction that you're making, I believe, but it has to do with a feeling.
With a feeling. A feeling of freedom about it. But also a feeling that, as I say, you take the good with the bad. I would no more have become an American citizen in 1940. I would no more have thought of it than, I don't know, jumping off the roof, because in 1940 you had, I was a French citizen and you had to take it. You know, France was defeated, France was in very bad position, but I had after all benefited as a French citizen from all kinds of things, and I think there were a number of us who felt that way, that this was no time to rush off and get naturalized.
No, I think I can follow that.
Can you follow that?
Yes, I think so. Thinking back to the events of those days.
That's right. You can't be French in good days and not French in bad days, as you cannot be not American for certain things and benefit, I mean, from American institutions and privileges. Now you have, it seems to me you've got to take it, the whole thing.